Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo's Gaelic football team on the west coast of Ireland.
When you look at the amount of times they've reached a final, you almost start believing something's not right.
Believing in the curse.
Amazing sports stories. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 15th of December, these are our main stories. Hungary blocks a $55 billion EU aid package to Ukraine and now says it may continue to do so. The US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan urges Israel to do more to limit civilian casualties in Gaza. In a case brought by Prince Harry, a judge in London has ruled there was extensive phone hacking by a newspaper group over a number of years. Also in this podcast, it's 40 below zero in parts of China. How are people coping? And we preview Serbia's local and general elections this weekend.
In media, especially those mainstream, most influential for Serbian citizens media, there is a chronic lack of pluralism.
The Hungarian Prime Minister has warned he's prepared to stop any further attempts to send European Union money to Ukraine. Viktor Orban was speaking after he vetoed a package of aid worth $55 billion at the EU summit in Brussels. But he also suggested he could lift his veto on money for Kyiv if the EU released more funds destined for Hungary. On Thursday, Mr. Orban absented himself from a vote which granted Ukraine the right to begin formal EU membership talks, but didn't rule out ending the talks later.
Let's be clear. Ukraine is not ready to be part of the EU. This decision is premature. The situation is not ripe for it. I've said, let's come back to this issue when Ukraine is ready. But they couldn't be convinced. Once again, I struggled for 8 hours to explain to them that helping the wrong way is worse than not helping at all. And what they want is to give Ukraine, through this decision, the encouragement it needs to continue the war.
I got more from our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhard, in Brussels.
Hungary's position broadly, Nick, is that it doesn't want these funds to come out of the EU budget. It says that basically there needs to be a strategic debate about Ukraine. It thinks that the war is going nowhere and there needs to be some sort of move towards peace negotiations. Kyiv obviously would reject that out of hand, and other EU nations back Kyiv in that position. It's often characterised as being Viktor Orban being a friend of Vladimir Putin, which is true. He's the closest leader within the EU to Vladimir Putin and has maintained relations with him throughout the war. He even met him in October and recently in Beijing. But it's more complicated than that, because Hungary also has this long-running dispute with the European Commission, whereby the European Commission froze about 30 billion euros worth of funds in disputes with democratic issues such as the rule of law in Hungary, academic freedoms, the treatment of asylum seekers, these sort of things. And it only on the eve of the summit released about a third of that, 10 billion euros of those frozen funds. And it's clear from both what Viktor Orban says and also what his advisers say that actually Hungary believes it should be getting 100% of those funds. And that clearly is a condition, it seems, before it moves on wider Ukraine funding. It's not against funding Ukraine in general, but it also points out that EU nations can all individually fund Ukraine as much as they want. And that may be the way that the EU takes if it can't get Hungary to agree to release European budget funds, form a different mechanism that works outside of the budget.
Danny, it sounds from the outside as though Hungary is effectively trying to blackmail the EU. How is it viewed there?
Well, a journalist put that precise question to Viktor Orban's political advisor here in the summit, who came out of discussions to brief journalists. And he rejected that out of hand. He said that actually it's other countries within the EU that have been blackmailing Hungary over these frozen funds, for example, the COVID recovery funds and the cohesion funds that the European Commission has got. Now, lots of people, again, reject that position from Hungary, but it's something they maintain. And it seems as though their lever over the months ahead will be as much to do with the release of those funds as anything else. But obviously, the EU, as I said, have other ways, and they may decide that rather than trying to persuade Hungary, if Hungary is not moving, that they will set up something else, a separate structure. So I don't think the matter's dead, and Kyiv can, I would have thought, expect funds of some description in the months ahead.
Danny Eberhardt. Well, as it stands, more than $100 billion worth of aid to Ukraine is blocked, 50 or so in the EU, and more than 60 is stalled in the US Congress. The BBC's Abdul-Jalil Abdurasulov has visited the front lines in eastern Ukraine to hear how concern over ally support is affecting troops.
An artillery unit of Ukraine's 93rd Brigade receives intel on a new target to destroy. The entire crew of the US-made M109 howitzer springs into action. The engine roars. One of the soldiers loads the gun. Another one pulls the cord. The evening explosion shakes the armoured machine. We are near the town of Bakhmut, which Russians took last May, but has failed to advance any further since then.
I'm looking at the M109 Paladin self-propelled howitzer. It's a huge gun. Basically, it looks like a tank with a big barrel. It's hidden under a tent, so that Russian drones will not be able to spot it. And weapons like these, provided by Western countries, make a huge difference on the front line.
As the conflict increasingly turns to stalemate, it's demoralizing for Ukrainian soldiers to hear that America's funding for Ukraine has ground to a halt. Sashko, a gunner.
If there is no military support from the West, then things will be really bad. First, Russia will seize Ukraine, then it will be the turn of the Baltic states, Poland. I think Russia will not stop here.
After one round of fire, Sashko and the rest of the crew are told to hide the gun. They throw branches of trees and cover the machine with camouflage nets. But soldiers worry that their guns will remain silent for much longer without continued Western funding and supplies. Sashko again.
Without ammunition, this American howitzer will just be scrap metal. It will be a nice machine. We can drive it, but we won't be able to fight with it.
Careful, careful.
We visit a different artillery unit fighting nearby. They used 2S1 Gvozdika system, a Soviet artillery relic. Its commander admits that they face a shortage of ammunition. After loading the gun, the crew has to wait for hours for the command to open fire on a high-value target. They simply cannot afford to waste ammunition on anything else. The latest developments in the US Congress creates a sense of disillusionment here. Kent, one of the gunners, expresses his frustration.
Our Western partners must understand that if we fail to stop Russians, then they will go further, and then instead of helping us, will be defending their own lands, and their own people will be dying.
Though the future is uncertain, Ukrainian soldiers say they will continue to defend their land with or without external aid.
That was Abdul-Jalil Abdurasulov. Russia is fighting Ukraine on many fronts, and not all of them are military. The BBC has discovered evidence of a large-scale Russian disinformation campaign involving thousands of fake accounts that spread false details about Ukraine on TikTok. Its videos routinely attract millions of views and appear to have the aim of undermining Western support for Ukraine in the war. Olga Robinson is from BBC Verify.
TikTok told the BBC that it's taken down more than 12,000 fake accounts belonging to what it described as a sophisticated influence operation originating in Russia, after the BBC flagged the activity of the network to them. Posing as ordinary users, the fake accounts portray Ukraine's leaders as corrupt and sanctions on Russia as harmful to Europeans. One of those targeted was the former Ukrainian defense minister Alexei Reznikov, who was accused of buying luxury villas in France and Spain. BBC Verify found these claims to be false. Mr. Reznikov's daughter, Anastasia Steinhaus, told the BBC she thinks this is Russia trying to undermine Western aid for Ukraine.
When the government of your country says, let's help Ukraine, let's stand with Ukraine, on the one hand, you see this. On the other hand, you receive a video where you see that money that you gave to these Ukrainians is going not to win the war, but to buy a villa or to buy a car. Of course, you don't want to stand with Ukraine at this moment.
The BBC is still finding new accounts in the network, and TikTok says it's continuing to monitor the situation.
Olga Robinson. As we record this podcast, the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan is due to meet Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah. Mr. Sullivan was in Jerusalem on Thursday with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The US has firmly backed Israel's war on Hamas since Hamas attacked southern Israel on October the 7th. Mr. Sullivan spoke ahead of the meeting.
The control of Gaza, the administration of Gaza, and the security of Gaza has to transition to the Palestinians. Now, the question of how that transition occurs, over what timetable, that is also something that we are having intensive discussions about. But the U.S. position on this is clear. We do not believe that it makes sense or is right for Israel to occupy Gaza, reoccupy Gaza over the long term.
Our correspondent Yolan Nell has this update from Jerusalem.
There have been fierce battles between Israeli forces and Hamas fighters in pockets across Gaza, as well as Israeli airstrikes in the center and south of the territory, with children reportedly among the dead. Speaking after what he described as very constructive talks with Israeli leaders, the U.S. National Security Advisor, Mr. Sullivan, said it would take months to achieve Israel's objectives in the war, but that fighting would proceed in phases, with a shift away from the intensity of the current campaign. He added that giving a time frame for this would be irresponsible. The US official then travelled to Ramallah, having said there's a need to revamp and revitalise the Palestinian Authority. Washington is pressing for the authority to have a role in Gaza's future governance, despite its low popularity with the Palestinian public and opposition from Israel.
Yolan Nell. Well, the conflict in Gaza, which has seen nearly 2 million people displaced, has been dominating a UN forum on refugees in Geneva. This year, even before the war in Gaza, countries across the world were trying to deal with a record 114 million refugees or internally displaced people. The newsroom's Janat Jalil is at the refugee forum.
For the past couple of days, this forum has seen pledges of millions of dollars of aid from countries, sports authorities and businesses to help the unprecedented number of people who've been forcibly displaced because of war, persecution or other human rights violations. But the UN Refugee Agency, which has organised this forum, says this still isn't enough. Despite the scale of the problem, humanitarian agencies like the UNHCR say they've seen their funding fall to the lowest level for years. And that was before the crisis in Gaza. I spoke to the head of the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, Philippe Lazzarini, who's been in Gaza this week and has described it as hell on earth. He said huge numbers of people are forced to camp outside. They're going hungry in a way he's never seen before, begging for a scrap of bread or gobbling food aid as soon as they get it on the spot.
I just come back from Gaza. I have seen the huge discrepancy between the immensity of the needs of the people and the crippling of the humanitarian assistance entering into the Gaza Strip.
Do you think the lack of food, the lack of aid, the lack of shelter, basic things, do you think Israel is using those as a weapon of war against Palestinians?
I believe, and I have warned more than once, that very soon people in the Gaza Strip might not die because of the bombardment only, but they might also start to die because of the impact of the siege. And what I have seen, being now in winter, 70 days into the war, with a weakened immunity of the people, with an outbreak of a disease that we might be on the eve of a massive death in the Gaza Strip.
Now, Israel has rejected allegations that it's collectively punishing Palestinians. Away from Gaza, conflicts in Ukraine, Colombia, Afghanistan and Sudan, among other places, have caused a record surge in the number of refugees, more than 35 million people. But contrary to perceptions in the West, where anti-immigrant politicians are reaping the benefits of growing hostility to asylum seekers, three quarters of the world's refugees are actually hosted by low and middle income countries, which are already struggling to provide for their own citizens. So this forum is looking at what more can be done to help create education and employment opportunities for displaced people and to change perceptions by, for instance, hearing from refugees themselves, some of whom have gone on to achieve great things, such as being chosen to participate in next year's Paris Olympics.
Jeanette Jalil. Still to come in this podcast, Australians pay a final farewell to a national treasure.
It's in honour of the extraordinary talent of Barry Humphries. And we idolised him.
It's a bit like the Queen. He should not have died.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler, and this is The Global Story from the BBC World Service.
China and America came together and agreed on this climate issue.
We're here to look beyond the headlines, peel back lazy assumptions, and give you a fresh global perspective on the stories that matter.
Is Europe tiring in terms of its support for Ukraine?
There will have to be some kind of negotiation to end this war.
Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Voters in Serbia get to elect a new parliament this weekend, and as our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay reports, this is a significant test for President Aleksandar Vučić.
Serbia's parliamentary elections are just a matter of days away. The same goes for municipal elections in the capital Belgrade and many other places around the country. Here outside the National Assembly, there are banners and billboards aplenty for most of the different party lists. But the most recent polls were only held last April, so the mood isn't so much here we go as here we go again.
The opposition claimed that we have lost the credibility, the legitimacy, and that elections need to be held.
Ana Brnabic has been Serbia's prime minister since 2017. She's a member of the governing Progressive Party.
In the spirit of democracy, we wanted to say yes. We never run away from elections. You know, if someone thinks that we have lost legitimacy and wants to double-check it, we can always do that and see. However people vote, we will respect that.
The call for elections followed months of weekly protests in Belgrade and other big cities. People marched under the banner Serbia Against Violence. The demonstrations started after two mass shootings on consecutive days in May horrified the country. But quickly, opposition parties got involved. They claimed the shootings reflected a culture of rhetorical and physical violence promoted by President Aleksandar Vučić, the Progressive Party, and their allies in the media. Now, 15 parties have set aside their differences to fight the elections as the Serbia Against Violence coalition. Borko Stefanovic is the deputy leader of the centre-left Party of Freedom and Justice.
When it was obvious that the government will not fulfil any of the requests of the people in the streets, that's why we all, as we are all pro-European parties, we decided to come together and to do what people have been demanding from us for years.
The Serbia Against Violence coalition is the first credible opposition proposition in a decade, but they still face an uphill struggle. The governing party enjoys friendly coverage from much of the media, and their trump card is Serbia's president. Aleksandar Vučić isn't up for election, but he's given his name to the Progressives' electoral list, and he's all over the airwaves.
In 2023, President Vučić addressed the nation live more than 260 times.
Rasha Nedelkov is the program director of the Election Monitor, the Center for Research, Transparency and Accountability.
In past year, 95% of all interlocutors in Central News in five national TV stations were reserved for one group, group that is in the government, in a neutral and in a positive tone.
Nonetheless, Green Left Front members are in a jovial mood at a campaign event with European Greens.
Water cross, basically.
They're also part of the Serbia Against Violence coalition, but they're not promising their supporters overall victory. Biljana Djordjevic is their co-leader.
I don't think the changes can happen overnight. We in Green Left Front believe in changes bottom up, from cities, from municipalities. That's why winning the Belgrade elections is so important. And then in 6 months, you win in Novi Sad, that's the second biggest city, Niš, the third biggest city. And then things change.
The Progressive Party is also portraying a confident front. They're sticking to their lines about promoting Serbia's European Union membership while maintaining friendship with Russia and, above all, being a reliable party of government. We'll soon know whether the electorate agrees.
Guy Delaunay. A wave of extreme cold weather is extending its grip across China, with temperatures expected to fall as low as minus 40 degrees Celsius in some northern areas. The authorities are trying to ensure unbroken supplies of electricity during the cold snap and protect crops at risk of damage. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow is following developments.
I think it's pretty extreme because of its how widespread it is. As you say, China is a vast country in the far northeast. In winter, it gets very, very cold. I've been up there myself and I can attest to that, how cold it does get. But it's particularly cold across the whole of country, from the north east right down to the southwest in Tibet, where you have massive snowstorms blocking roads right across the country to the east in Shanghai, where you have trains cancelled, buses cancelled, and across a massive swathe of central and southern areas where there's fear for winter crops, so they're being protected. So I think what's unusual about this particular cold snap, which is going to extend for the next week or 10 days or so, is that it's more widespread. It's extended beyond areas which traditionally you would expect cold weather in China.
And Mickey, China's been grappling with weather extremes throughout this year, hasn't it?
It has. You've got to remember, China is such a vast country. Just before I came on air, I had a quick look at the temperature in the far south, Hainan Island, where people often go to winter because it's so hot. It's over 30 degrees there, so people are going to be on the beach. But yes, China is a country where there's vast differences in temperatures. But over recent years, there has been a tendency to have more extreme cases. So over the last few years, we've had a lot of drought in the south and the southwest. That's led to problems with hydroelectric power stations not functioning properly, crops failing. And already now, you've had two really severe cold snaps already this winter. Just in November in the northeast, there was extremely high levels of snow there. So what you are seeing a trend, as you're seeing across the rest of the world, is more extreme weather in a place which already has extreme weather.
And when you have extreme weather events in many parts of the world, the media pick up on this and sort of say, oh, is it climate change? Do similar kind of things happen in the press in China and the media in general?
Yeah, it's a good question. And sometimes, yes, and that is obviously something which is discussed. But in the official media, I've just been having a look, for example, at the official media, social media offerings and what they've been doing about the weather. Mostly, they haven't been talking about the accident which you mentioned there in Beijing, at which 100 people have broken bones or fractured bones. 500 people had to go to hospital when these two trains collided. There isn't a lot of mention of that or the negative effects of it, but there is a lot of pictures of people in enjoying themselves in the snow, ice being cut out of rivers to form ice festivals, which is an ice festival in Harbin, so they're preparing the ice there, or people enjoying themselves in temples on mountaintops. Not a lot of emphasis, really, on the colder weather and the disruption and the climate change, because the government likes to present a happy picture of life in China, not the negative side.
Mickey Bristow. Prince Harry has won a phone hacking case against a big newspaper group. He'd brought the case against Mirror Group newspapers, saying that they'd used unlawful means, like phone hacking, to get stories about him. The UK's High Court said it found widespread and habitual use of dishonest practices. Prince Harry's lawyer read a statement from him to reporters outside the court.
I've been told that slaying dragons will get you burned. But in light of today's victory and the importance of doing what is needed for a free and honest press, it is a worthwhile price to pay. The mission continues.
Our correspondent Sean Coughlan told me more about Harry's journey in the courts.
In some ways, it's a big day for him. He's had lots and lots of law cases against numerous newspaper groups. And here today, we had the biggest finding so far, an actual legal ruling on an evidence given in a massive case that was held in June in London. And it's found in Harry's favour. 15 out of 33 cases, he's been proven to have been hacked. I think he'll be very pleased with that. It's a difficult decision for the Mirror. They seem to have accepted it and said this was a long time ago. They're a different company now. And they, you know, they want to move on. There has been a question of damages. We know that there's £140,600 damages awarded to Prince Harry. But this has never been about the money. This has been about the principle. And I think he was willing not to settle out of court, willing to pursue his claim, willing to go to have his day in court and to risk cross-examination over 2 days in the summer so that he could eventually say, a court has said, I have been hacked. And so I think it is a sort of the biggest day, what's been a campaign of many years of his in his protests about how he's been treated by the press.
So to what extent, Sean, could this lead to a whole slew of other cases like this?
Well, it opens the door to other people coming to Mirror Group and saying they've also been victims. We know they've already paid out over £100 million in damages and legal costs over previous hacking claims. So this, again, could be a very high stakes for them if they have to pay out even more. And they might embolden other people to come forward and say that they also were victims. We don't know that yet, but certainly it's been talked about, dozens of people who might follow in Prince Harry's wake.
Now, this does seem to have been a very common way in which newspaper groups got information about prominent people. To what extent is that still likely to be going on, or has technology superseded it, do you think?
Well, you'd like to think it was very, very much stopped once awareness was raised about it. It was seen to be illegal, and we'd imagine newspaper groups stopped doing it. In this case, the judge has been very clear that this was widespread and habitual within this particular news group at that time. As we know, Prince Harry is also conducting other lawsuits against other newspaper groups, and they will strongly argue that they haven't been involved in this sort of practice and that their news stories were gathered by entirely legitimate means. But it does open that question again, which perhaps some of us might have thought had been put in the past. There's debates about phone hacking and stories which are from sometimes 20 years ago.
Sean Coughlan. A state memorial service has taken place at the Sydney Opera House for the entertainer Barry Humphries, who died in April, aged 89. Hundreds of people gathered to celebrate the life of the man behind the larger-than-life character Dame Edna Everidge, with tributes from King Charles and Sir Elton John.
Barry Humphries was one of the funniest people in the world, but you all know that. But he's also one of the kindest and most generous person to me. It's sad that we won't be seeing him again, but we have so many memories of him, his books, his TV appearances, and the wonderful jokes and the wonderful kindness that he showed to me and everyone.
Our correspondent Phil Mercer was at the service at the Sydney Opera House.
One of Australia's brightest stars has been remembered as a comic genius. The state memorial for Barry Humphries at the Sydney Opera House brought together family, friends and hundreds of fans.
Well, it's in honour of Edna, of course, and the extraordinary talent of Barry Humphries. And we idolised him.
It's a bit like the Queen. He should not have died. I came up last night especially to come to this memorial service.
King Charles said in a message that the entertainer was a cultured and erudite man who, through his creations, punctured pomposity. The actor Rob Brydon said he was the master and that there was nobody better than Barry Humphries. His most irrepressible creation was Dame Edna, an outrageous suburban housewife who would define his career. The actor's son Oscar said his father's work will always connect people to a different time.
He documents a sort of changing Australia and an Australia that doesn't exist anymore. We saw the ice cream truck on Bondi is now an acai bowl truck, and Dad would have put that in a show, you know, and he connects us to a very different Australia. You know, he grew up in the 1940s and 50s. But, you know, in the end, he just made us laugh, didn't he?
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, said this comedic giant brought such joy to every part of Australia and showered it upon the world.
Phil Mercer. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Muzajczka, and the producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.